happy as it is. So I suppose without further ado, just to introduce Paul Deasy. He's a GP and he's got a master in CBT, so he's just going to go through the sort of ideas about don't panic about anxiety and height. So I'll let him speak.
Thanks very much, Paul Deasy. My name, I'm a GP in Barrack Street, and I've done a bit of extra work in CBT and that sort of thing. And I suppose, I think this is very relevant to everybody, so I think it's a very good choice as a topic, you know. Now, before going further, I have to admit I am related to one or two of his in the audience, and I presume I'll be guaranteed plenty of feedback when I'm finished. I'm going to talk about what is anxiety, how is panic related to anxiety, cognitive behavioural concepts, and CBT in action. CBT, I suppose, what I'll do tonight is give you a brief outline of what it's about. And actually, I would hope that by the time you leave tonight, you'd have a good idea, particularly with regard to panic and how to deal with panic, both for yourselves and for other people that you might come across. Now, the first thing I'm going to do is I'm going to say, hands up anybody who gets anxious. That's not so bad. I've been curious about some of the people who don't put their hands up, but we'll get to that later. Any resemblance to anyone that you know or anything is purely accidental. Before I come back to this, I'd just like to tell you a story about 7-8 years ago when I was asked to present at a meeting. And it was a meeting to GPs, there were maybe 15 GPs there. And there was three speakers. I was the middle one. There was two of my hospital consultant colleagues were speaking as well. It was grand. A bit bitey first, no problem. I was second on, so my colleagues are up and 20 minutes. Nice talk, a few questions, all going well. Now it was my turn, introduced, up I stood, and I had no slides or anything, and I was standing at this podium, there we are, and so I was just about to start, where we go, and my leg started doing this. Now, the problem with it is, they're all sitting there, you can see this, they could all see that too, so I just stopped, went over, glass of water, prayed, another glass of water, back again and started, and the leg started again. My talk was 20 minutes, 25 minutes. My leg was hopping for 15 of those 20, 25 minutes. Now, the irony of it all was my presentation was about anxiety and panic. And there was I going through it on the spot. So we'll talk a little bit of why I was doing that and what I was doing there in a few minutes. This guy, it really starts back at this period when life was pretty simple for these guys, right? You were born, you lived until you could have babies, and then you minded the babies until they were old enough to look after themselves, and then it didn't matter what happened to you then. You'd fulfilled your duties, which was to have children, pass on the DNA. Life was very tough. It was all physical danger, wild animals, tribes over the hill who were coming to rob your wives, all these sort of things. Real physical dangers you had to fight, you had to flee from danger. Every rustle in the forest or whatever was potentially death, because, you know, if you got mauled by an animal, there was very little anyone could do for you. In order to survive, the human species evolved a very, very effective way of dealing with danger. And, you know, none of this is new to you. Flight or fight response, okay? So, what's this flight or flight response about? The whole object of it is to get oxygen and sugar to your muscles. More oxygen, sugar in muscles, the faster you can run, the better you can fight. So the system, which has evolved, incredibly efficient. So what happens? Autonomic nervous system, mainly sympathetic nervous system, release of adrenaline. What that happens then is that firstly we need to get more oxygen in. So our breathing respiratory rate increases. We need to get this oxygen around the body as fast as we can. Blood carries the oxygen, so let's get the blood going. The heart. So the heart starts beating faster and also stronger. So there's more blood being pumped out with every heartbeat, and there's more beats in every minute. So there's a huge increase in the circulation, how quickly the blood circulates around the body. The liver, which has stored, and the muscles, which store sugar, all that sugar is broken down and released into the circulation. A few other interesting things. Every time the blood beats, there's quite a high percentage of blood goes to the gut, and there's 30 odd feet of gut there, and there's a lot of blood going there. So what happens to the blood vessels going to the gut is they constrict up and they narrow down because blood is being wasted going to the gut. You've tigers run away from. So, you know, waste of time being there digesting your food. Tigers, you know, don't care, really, and they will just kill you anyway. So the blood is diverted away from the gut. So any food in the gut, digestion stops. The other organ of the body that takes a lot of blood is your skin, and all the blood vessels constrict into the skin. So it's an incredibly efficient way of getting blood to the muscle. And what happens then is like your muscles are turbocharged. You have strength that you didn't think you had, you can run faster, and all that was aim at either getting away from danger or fighting off danger. And it worked really well. We're still around today, you know, so it's really important. And I think this really was the reason that the human species survived. Now, the problem is, nowadays, we don't have too many tigers chasing us. And really, there's very few physical tigers every day. However, in the last few hundred years, most of the dangers we face now are called psychological dangers. So, God, I might fail my exam. Now, that might seem pretty petty compared to tigers chasing you, but actually it's not. You know, what happens if she doesn't like me? Or what happens if I mess? What happens if I'm standing making a talk here and I make a Horlicks of it? What will people think of me? These are all dangers as well, but they're called psychological dangers. And the problem is that the brain doesn't know the difference. All the brain gets and senses is danger. Doesn't know any difference about whether it's tigers or whether you're worried that people will think you're stupid. The brain is only one response to danger. It's like pressing a red button and it floods your system with adrenaline. Sympathetic nervous system firing off, adrenaline pouring around your body, doing all the changes, heartbeat, oxygen to the muscles, breathing increases, blood supply decreased to your skin, to your gut. The difficulty is that that doesn't help when you're dealing with psychological danger. The ability to run fast when you're waiting to go in for an exam isn't much good yet. The ability to, you know, fight as if your life depended just because you are afraid that you might miss a penalty in a soccer match, again, isn't going to be much help to you. So, basically, if you're standing there and your flight or fight response is fired off, your heartbeat is beating very fast, your breathing has got a bit funny, a bit tight, maybe your chest is a bit soreness across your chest, a bit tight maybe, your tummy feels a bit funny, you might have a mad urge to want to go to the toilet. And sometimes you might find that the hand is shaking a little bit, and you might be afraid to talk because you might feel a bit croaky or what's going to happen. And there's one very good solution to this, just run. As fast as you can, no problem, because that's what your body is preparing to do. Or if you can find somebody to fight, fair enough, do that as well. But that's the answer, because that's what your body is preparing to do. The problem is, though, this is a psychological danger, and your body, the what your body has done is no good when you're dealing with this current danger. If we're around for another 10,000 years, we might have evolved a different way of dealing with it. But at the moment, we don't. Your brain can't tell the difference between them. So what's anxiety? Very simple. Thoughts and physical symptoms generated by psychological threats. Now, so we get psychological threats every day, multiple times a day. So basically, we all get anxious. Every single one of us. Right? And, you know, so people thinking that anxiety is almost like a condition or a disease, or we'd have to stay quiet about it because God knows we couldn't tell anyone about that. Well, the people you're afraid that might find out about it also get it as well. So they know exactly what you're talking about. Panic. What's panic then? So you're there and you're get up and you have a big exam that particular day. And it's a bit dodgy. Thought you'd get the study done, but not quite. I knew I shouldn't have gone out Friday night. And really, do you know, could have done a little bit more. A bit worried about it. You know, you do pretty well, but this is not so sure what could come up. Is there a chance you might pass it? Maybe. Wouldn't that be awful? What a disaster. So your brain just registers danger. My God, this is awful. We'll have to do something about that. We need to get away from it. Adrenaline, hurry up, get in there, fast. Heartbeat, let's start. Whoa. Gotta get that sugar out into the muscles because my God, we must run very fast or fight hard. Now you're at home and you've an hour to go before the exam and you're sitting there and your heart is going thump, 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 thump and you're tight, chest is kind of tight and your stomach is funny. You couldn't eat breakfast. My God, no, the stomach was a bit odd. And this is the third time I've gone to the toilet. Now, come on, this is ridiculous. And, you know, and you're sitting down, you can't relax, and you're pacing, whatever. And then you're kind of saying, God, breathing's a bit funny. And you start taking big breaths, and you kind of feel, jeekers, you know what, no, I can't get enough air into my lungs, and I can't get a deep enough breath in, and jeekers, my heart is doing funny things. But, you know, I hope there's nothing wrong with it. No, your brain is there and it's kind of going, breathing, heart, something wrong with it. Oh my God, that's very dangerous. Jesus, this is awful. So what it does, there's that red button, your brain goes, beep, more adrenaline pumping out into your body. So you thought you might be having a little bit of trouble with your heart and chest beforehand. Now you know you're getting a heart attack. Your heart rate has now increased and your chest has now become way tighter, right? Now, you're sweating, you're really worried. If anyone walked in the door there, now they'd see you deathly pale at this stage because all this blood supply has gone out of your, it's all going to your muscles. You're dead. You've convinced that this, no. Funny enough, your brain doesn't like that either. More alarm bells, more adrenaline pumping through your body. So now you're in a heightened state of anxiety and it seems to be getting worse. The worst thing about it, though, is you don't actually even know how it started. You were examined suddenly, you're in this state where you don't know what to do with yourself. That is a panic attack. Now, if anyone's experienced panic attacks, it is very, very nasty when you're in the middle of one. It is very nasty, and it's not any wonder to think that something very nasty is going to happen. Some people end up in the A&E department. In they go, and when they eventually get in, 2 hours later, if they're lucky, and of course it's all gone away at that stage. So they're sitting down there, and what's wrong with you? And they're trying to describe my heart and my breathing. It felt like they're having a heart attack. Now the thing is they've never had a heart attack before, so they don't know what a heart attack is like, but anyway, it felt like a heart attack. And they're sitting there, nice and calmly at this stage, feeling a bit like an idiot, and the doctor saying, oh yeah, okay, whatever, and because you're an A&E, you will get an ECG, you probably will get bloods, and they'll do all these things, they'll tell you, you're fine, it was only a panic attack, you can go away. And you're relieved, and that's fine, whatever, and then you leave, and you can kind of say, but hold on a sec, no, I was there at home, and there I was, everything hunky-dory, then this thing happened, and the doctor's telling me, it's only a heart attack. What does that mean? Does that mean there was nothing wrong with me? And then you feel a bit idiotic about it, and you're kind of hoping it'll never start again. But then, someday down the line, you start getting anxious about something else. And again, the old heart starts beating, and the old the breathing starts getting a bit tighter, and then you're worried that, my God, what happens if somebody sees me? Wouldn't that be really awful? And then, of course, your brain goes, oh God, this is very dangerous. More adrenaline, same thing again. Heart beats faster, breathing gets tighter, chest gets tighter, more adrenaline, and again, you're back in the same boat. And then you don't know what to do because the doctor said it was only a panic attack. Therefore, this is nothing, and I should, but actually, I feel as if there is some disaster going to happen. And again, we mightn't get any department this time, but it eventually settles down. But the problem is, you're now sensitized to it, and you're now thinking about it, and you know it appears out of nowhere, as far as you can see, because you can't see a cause for it, and nobody's really given you an accurate explanation. And God, I couldn't go to any department because I felt like an idiot the last time, and then they told me, sure, it was only a panic attack. But of course, they did ECGs and all these things first because they had to check to make sure. But if it was only a panic attack, why did they have to check to do all those sort of things? Could he not tell that? Therefore, maybe it is very dangerous, so maybe I should be going to the doctor when it happens. And really, people just don't really know what to do, become really frightening, and they then become afraid of getting panic. So what are we going to do about it? Well, what we're going to do now is we're going to do some CBT about it. Okay? So this is your first dip into CBT. You'll all be doing it. Okay? Panic is getting anxious about the symptoms of anxiety, spiraling of anxiety. So the first thing with panic is it doesn't last. It always tails off and it always stops. And a very easy explanation for that I give people is that you run out of adrenaline. Body doesn't have any more adrenaline. Needs to make more, doesn't have time, so the adrenaline level drops down, your heart rate slows down, the breathing rights itself, and suddenly it all goes away. The whole flight and fight response is it's like a turbo charge. It's temporary. It's to throw all the resources in to get away from danger. It doesn't last. 15 to 20 minutes, in some cases, is probably about the maximum. The second thing is nothing bad actually happens. Whatever the fears are, I'll stop breathing, I'll get a heart attack, I'll collapse, you name it. All these dangers that enter your head, actually nothing happens. And everything just settles and goes away. And you probably feel knackered, tired after it because there's a lot of energy gone into it, but actually nothing else happens. So when I have people that come in, I suppose maybe two or three times ever have I had somebody come into the desk, to the girls at the desk and say, I'm in the middle of a panic attack, I need a doctor, what am I going to do? So based on what we're talking about, what do we do for these people? Okay, so when the girls are in the room and say, Paul, so-and-so's here, they feel they're in the middle of a panic attack. So I will go out to them and I will say, okay, and I suppose you have to be pretty sure yourself that what they're calling panic is panic, but a very brief questioning, and you can be pretty sure of it. And then what I say is, you sit in there, and I will be back to you when you're finished your panic attack. And I walk away. Now, why would I do that? Well, if I'm there and I'm fussing over them, the message I'm giving is, geez, panic attacks, that's very important. It'll leave the patient inside and come out and rescue me from this panic attack, which that's the exact opposite message you want to give people. So what I would say is, you sit there, you finish, you have your panic attack, you finish off your panic attack, I'll be back to you when you're finished. The other thing is, you can't talk to people in the middle of a panic attack. By the way, if you come across anyone who's having a panic attack, the last thing in the world you say to them is, just relax. If I could feckin' relax, I wouldn't be like this. Okay? It's the last thing in the world they want to hear. They can't relax. That's the whole point of it. They're charged up, and relaxation is the last thing they can do. So what I say is, have your panic attack. That's fine. So immediately the underlying message I'm giving people is that, okay, he's not worried about it. That's fine. cussing and swearing, but anyway, I come back to them 10 or 15 minutes later, and we sit down, we talk about it. And I talk about some of these things, right? Do we give tablets or medicines? Absolutely not. Why would we do that? All we're doing here is people getting anxious about getting anxious. So all we have to try and do is stop them getting anxious about being anxious, and they'll never get a panic attack again. Never get a panic attack again. Not that they won't get anxious again. Yes, of course, because we all get anxious, because every single day, on multiple occasions, we're faced with psychological dangers. I'm late, I'm running late, I'm too late, or I'm too early. God, if I'm early there, I'll be on my own, and sure, people will be looking at me, wouldn't that be awful? I'm late, they'll all be looking at me when I come in the door anyway, so I have to get there perfectly timed, and that will guarantee I won't be anxious. You know, but what happens if I pick the wrong place, like when they still won't be there and I thought I was on time? I'd be anxious about that too. We're always getting anxious. The problem is we don't always have to get panicked though. Because if we leave being anxious at just being anxious, and that's it, and don't start horribilizing being anxious, well then we'll never get panicked. Leave anxiety where it is. It's just being anxious and nothing more than that. The problem about panic is that it tends to spiral and get worse because your brain doesn't know any different. All it's doing is trying to protect you. And if we keep presenting it with danger, and the two things that your brain will respond quickest to with regard to danger is your heart and your lungs, because it knows. You'll never get panic over a "Oh my God, look!" Because your brain knows, okay, fine, we can cut it off, that's all right. But your heart, your lungs, and funny enough, other things, what people might think of me, is another very, very strong reason why people will get panic. Okay? But if you just leave the panic where it is and stop stimulating the brain to feel that just because you get anxious, that it's actually dangerous. It's not. It's just an inappropriate, it's actually, if you think about it, what we call anxiety is a reaction. The body is there to protect you. It's there to protect you, and it has done so for hundreds of thousands of years. And sure, all species have some sort of flight or fight response, keep away from danger. So it's protected. So how could something that's there to protect us, and we have kept through evolution, how could that be dangerous? And yet we keep telling ourselves it's dangerous when it happens. But we must get rid of it, and it must be a condition, and we must treat it. There must be some sort of treatment. The problem with giving people medications who might get panic is that you're legitimizing it as being some sort of condition. A condition that needs treatment, and I have to go to the doctor about that. So what you're trying to do is you're trying to normalize what's going on. Everybody gets anxious, just leave it at being anxious. And very often if you draw off previous experiences and say, tell me, so what happened the last time you got anxious or got panic? Well, it went away. Right, and what about the time before that? Yeah, it went away. What about the other 15 times you got it? So what makes you think you're going to get a heart attack this time, not the other 14 times? And drawing people's own experience with regard to what has happened and what they did, whatever, and basically the underlying message you're giving is that everyone gets anxious. That doesn't mean you have to like it. That doesn't mean you can't do things to try and maybe stop yourself getting anxious about particular things. But look, it's just one of these things. But you don't have to get anxious about the fact you're anxious. So I will tell people, do I get anxious? Of course I get anxious. Anxious all the time about various things. I'm not anxious all the time, but you know, you get anxious about things every day. You get anxious. And it could they be stupid things? Of course, they might logically seem to be stupid, but they're not stupid to your emotional brain. They're quite serious, actually. So we all get anxious, but I will tell patients that I never get panic. And that's there for everybody. It's open to everybody. Never to get panic. If you just remember, all is happening is I'm getting anxious about this. And how anxious can people get? Well, I'm sure you might have done physiology, things like low calcium causing, things like carpopedal spasm and that sort of thing. People can hyperventilate so much that they send their calcium levels way down and they get all these these funny things and hands and face and all this sort of thing. That used to be a favourite one inside me. Physiology lectures back in my day with a guy called Jack Sheehan. He'd be telling us how to do this and we can chicken and this and that sort of thing. And it's pure over breathing. And that can be caused by just pure anxiety about what is happening. And nothing bad happens. And that's what you emphasize. You emphasize that it's completely normal to get anxious about something. Absolutely, and really, we don't try to cure anxiety because it is not a condition. It's a kind of name we give to something happening at the wrong time. We manage anxiety. Can we cure panic? Absolutely. We can get to the stage where we can say to people, you know, we can get you to a position where you will never panic again. Now, the other thing about it is going up to the casualty department tends to make things worse rather than make things better. Because you go into the casualty department, they are guaranteed to do tests on you. They're guaranteed to do cardiographs. And I can understand why. You go up there, you see a junior doctor and somebody coming in, they're worried about their heart and whatever, and the first thing, in fact, the ECG might be done before the even doctor sees you. The problem with that is, and there are grounds for doing that, and sometimes I let people come in to me, and it might sound like panic, but there's probably a little bit more doubt there, and you still might need some investigations. But the problem about a pure panic attack, if you start investigating it, you're just legitimizing it. Not that it didn't happen, it absolutely happened, but you're legitimizing it as being some sort of medical problem. And it's not a medical, there's nothing wrong with it. In fact, their heart is working perfectly well. Beautiful response to adrenaline. So if there's tigers chasing it, works perfectly well. Fantastic. The thing about it though is, usually by the time you get to the anxiety, you need to burn, it's all gone away anyway. Do you know? And you're kind of sitting there and you're kind of going, oh my God. And you almost have to convince people how bad it was, that you go to the trouble. Like, do you think anybody think that you'll go up to a casualty department and sit two or 3 hours or whatever it is these days, just for the fun of it? Come on, give us a break. Like, it obviously is very, very, it's a very uncomfortable feeling. And if you think about it and let your emotional brain run away with you, it's obviously life-threatening. So the whole thing about treating panic is that it is not like panic. It is uncomfortable. Getting anxious is uncomfortable. Getting anxious is not nice. And this is the sort of things you say, but you know, it's only anxiety. It's only anxiety. No more than that. It's only anxiety. So don't catastrophize it. Explain to people what's happening. And I've just explained it to you tonight. You just explain what's happening in your body. And actually, the explanation goes a long, long way to helping people give a bit of understanding to it. They don't understand, because it comes out of the blue. They don't realize that what starts to get all off is the fact that I'm feeling a little bit anxious. And they don't, to them it appears out of the blue. Out of the blue, I started this thing and look at me now, I'm a complete mess. It doesn't start out of the blue, they just don't understand what triggers it off. So don't catastrophize, explain to people and draw previous experiences. And that's how you cure panic. Do you think you can do that?
Yeah.
Might hold you to that. Cognitive behavioral concept. So, just a brief discussion with regard to cognitive behavioral therapy, what's that about? So, activating factor, trigger, and consequences. So, we hear things like, he made me angry, cut me off in traffic, and my God, that was his fault. Look at me now, I'm angry. Or, you know, she made me very depressed because she dumped me, right? Now, and that sounds logical and reasonable. The problem about it is, what you're saying is you are controlled completely by what happens to you and what other people do and what other people say and what events happen to you, and you have no control. So it's like, you know, a comedian and he made me laugh, fine, which means that if he made you laugh, he should make everybody laugh because he's got control. And so the guy next to you is going to say, no, I didn't think that was funny. Well, what's happening there? If he made you laugh, he made you not laugh. Well, what's going on there? So there is some sort of problem with that kind of dynamic And it's been known for a long time. This guy, his name is Marcus Aurelius. He was one of the good emperors in Rome. He was a soldier, and he had to do a lot of fighting because the Roman Empire was under a little bit of restraint at that stage. And he's what's called one of the Stoic philosophers. And the Stoic philosophers start, I suppose, the Stoicism started in Athens around the 3rd century BC. And, you know, they were talking about kind of virtue was the ultimate happiness was virtue, and you judged a man by his behavior, not what we'd be talking about. And so Marcus Aurelius did a lot of writing, and we just took this sentence from "Your life is what your thoughts make it." So suddenly we have this kind of concept of thoughts, and if anybody really wanted to do a little bit of looking about Stoicism, that's a lovely book actually. Anyway, moving along. Buddha. No, so Buddha had nothing to do with the Roman Empire. This is what I use actually as my screensaver on my computer. All that we are is the result of what we have thought. The mind is everything. What we think, we become. So again, the concept of thinking as being a deciding factor on how we live our lives. William Shakespeare was never caught for a word or two. There's nothing either good or bad, but thinking makes it so. So we're back to, again, this concept of our thoughts have a lot to do with how our life goes and how we experience life. So I suppose we have what's called the ABC. So instead of the A going directly to see the consequences, how we feel, what we do, we have this little B in between, which belief, our thoughts, our chat, what it is that we tell ourselves about what's happening. So let me give you an example. So you decide you're going to invite 4 or 5 people over for something to eat, and you invite Mary, and Mary's, you know, Grant, no problem, I'll be there, and Mary never shows up, right? So how are you going to feel about Mary not showing up? Well, very angry. You went particularly out of your way to invite Mary. And now I shouldn't even text, like, come on, in this day and age, you can't do something. Text, message, do something, I don't know. But seriously, she never told me that she wasn't coming, and you're angry and upset. Or maybe because you were talking to Mary the day before, and actually she didn't look very well, and you were kind of going, she was coughing and spluttering a bit, but she said, I'll see you tomorrow. I'll see you tomorrow. And then you're maybe thinking, Mary didn't turn up, maybe she's sick, maybe she's in bed, maybe you're kind of a bit concerned for her, and maybe that, sure, I might get on to her, you know. We'll see. Or maybe Mary was all set to go, and as she was going out the door, she got a phone call. Her mother had just been rushed to hospital, and Mary's like, so now suddenly when you hear that, oh, you're all concerned. My God, poor Mary. Or maybe you just don't like Mary at all anyway, and you're glad she didn't come. So you're like, yes, thanks be to God, I only invite her out of guilt. So there you have 4 consequences for the same thing, Mary not turning up. It's just you thought about it in 4 different ways, and you have 4 different consequences. So people were playing around with this, and they said, well, if your beliefs or your thoughts get you into trouble, so for example, if my belief was making me angry, and I don't want to be angry, what happens if we work on the beliefs, and if we change our beliefs or thoughts or self-chat or what we're talking about, and see, will that change the consequences? And this is the origins of CBT then. And we got these two guys, Aaron Beck on the left and Albert Ellis on the right, and they were kind of both Freudian psychoanalysts, tell me about your childhood, and to do with your father after this and all that sort of thing. And that was the rage back in the 40s, 30s and 40s and that, when they were working. But actually they both moved away from it for the simple reason that they found it didn't work very well. And you had people in therapy for years, and yeah, they got something out of it, but a lot of the time they still had the same problems that they had when they went into therapy, and they kind of moved away. And both of them looked at this idea of, let's look at the thoughts and see if we can do something about that. So, and they both developed a kind of track in CBT which is very, very similar. Aaron Beck on the left is the guy who was what we call the traditional CBT, and Albert Ellis is the guy, slight variation called REBT. So let me give you an example. So I'm giving my talk to my 60 GPs. It was 50, well, I got 60 now. They were all there, and my leg is hopping down, up and down. I'm thinking, oh my God, they'll see this, and they'll think I'm stupid, or there's something wrong with me, or whatever like that. I'm sure, how can I be talking to them about anxiety, and look at me, for feck's sake, like, come on, what's going on here? Like, you know, and these kinds of thoughts are going through my head. Whereas Aaron Beck will say, oh, come on, let's look at this. Surely, look, all these people, they know it. Firstly, how many of them honestly think you're stupid? Come on. Well, okay, that's open to debate. And another thing, look, they know about people getting anxious, and that's right. So what they'll do, what Aaron Beck will do is he'll look at your thoughts and he'll try to kind of tell you that all these things you're fearing in your head, you're catastrophizing and you're kind of, you know, exaggerating them, and let's get back down to brass tacks. And come on, really, they're not going to think you're stupid, and you know, what are the chances and whatever. And he'll say, fine, okay. Albert Ellis has a different approach. What he'll say is, yeah, you're right, they may all think you're stupid, but so what? Now, funnily enough, that actual approach tends to do better than Aaron Beck's approach, because Aaron Beck would say, you know, you can always come back and say, okay, but maybe that girl over there thinks I'm stupid. Maybe the rest of them don't, or maybe that guy thinks I'm weak. And you can't ever tell somebody 100% that no, they don't. You know, because, you know, there'll be people, everyone might say, no, we don't, but secretly in the head might say, actually, we do, but I can't tell them that, you know. So whereas the Albert Ellis approach would say, yeah, they may all think you're stupid and you don't know what you're doing, but so what? They're still there listening to you. They didn't all walk out. So, you know, you just will never know anyway. So crack on, you know. Now, examples of distorted thinking. This is Aaron Beck's. You look at the thinking and that gets you into trouble, and there'll be various characteristics of thinking. We already talked about horribilizing, catastrophizing. So what we were doing about the panic is we were doing CBT. We were looking at the thoughts that somebody has and saying, this is awful, look at me, jeekers, what's going to happen to me? So at that stage, you're horribilizing there and catastrophizing. So what we're doing is we're telling people, oh, come on, let's look at the evidence. Look at the evidence of what's going on here. You know, you've had this before, nothing has happened to you, look, it's all settled down now, you're only young, and you don't think there's something wrong with your heart at 23 years of age. And so what you're doing is you're calming it all down, you're de-horribilizing what's going on. So you're doing CBT. Magnifying or minimizing, so these are things that says, you know, if things go right, you're sure everybody could do it, and if things go wrong, no, I'm the only one that it would have happened to. Mind reading, oh yeah, everybody, you know, everyone will think I'm stupid if I make a mistake. You've decided in your head that that's what people will think. And overgeneralization, you know, you fail one exam, there's no point me doing any exams because I haven't a chance, I'll fail them all, and that's the end of it. And you can see how these sort of thoughts and thinking gets people to feel anxious. So when a CBT therapist challenges the client's thinking by looking at how their thinking matches reality, and basically gets people to go through it and that sort of thing, and in the process try to take away the danger. And if there's no danger, your brain doesn't get stimulated to start the flight or fight response. And if your brain isn't getting stimulated to start the flight or fight response, you don't get anxious. Simple as that. Albert Ellis, the Big Macs. He took, as I say, a slightly different way of, and he felt that all what we call distorted thinking or irrational thinking could be divided into, could come under one of four different categories. So the first one is masturbation, or demanding, must, should, have to. Okay? I have to get this right, because if I don't get it right, blah, 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 whatever. You know, I must be on time, because if I'm not on time, everyone will be looking at me and God knows what they might be thinking. I must pass my exams because it would be absolutely a disaster if I don't, and I'll never get a job, and sure, I might have to repeat, and then I'll have to go into a new class and everyone will be looking at me because they'll be always looked at, all failures exams, all failures. Do you know? So that's masturbation. And behind every bit of anxiety, Ellis would have said, there is a must. There is a should, or there is a must. somewhere. We're telling ourselves in our brain something must happen or should happen. Awfulization, that's where we catastrophize again. You know, pain in your chest must be a heart attack. Failing one exam is the end of the world. Mary didn't turn up at the dinner party because she doesn't like me and she thinks I'm a terrible person. So it's exaggerating consequences of actions or what might happen. Can't standitis is the you know, I can't cope. I can't cope with this. And actually, a lot of that is to do with anxiety as well. One of the problems people have is they get anxious and they feel it difficult to cope with the feelings they get of anxiety. And the last one, self or other downing, that's where people would be telling themselves, you know, if I make a mess of this, it means I'm a failure. And that's an underlying, the underlying concept with regard to depression. I am a failure. And if something bad happens, I am a failure. And as I say, that's self or other downing. So, in surgery, how do we see anxiety? Anxiety panic spiral, we already talked about it. Ego anxiety is the what do people think of me? And that's very, very common. In fact, you know, it can get so bad. It's social anxiety, people not leaving the house, not leaving the house. And very often you get to ask people, so why won't you leave the house? And they can't even tell you the reason, because I suppose they'll start feeling anxious, and the reason they won't leave is because they feel anxious. But why are they feeling anxious? They don't get beyond the anxiety thing. They find it very hard because they don't want to get anxious, and they know that if I don't leave the house, I won't get anxious. So you're not triggering the worry, and if you don't trigger the worry, where therefore you won't get anxious. So, for example, if people, you have people who won't fly, even though they've never been up on a plane in their life. Don't know what flying a plane is like, yet they'll never fly and they get anxious at the thought of even flying, right? And as long as they are never put in a position where they might have to fly somewhere or go somewhere, they will never ever get anxious about flying. It's only when it's presented to them and they start thinking about it, they start getting anxious. So you're sitting there and there's people telling you how anxious they are. They have never been in a plane in their life. They're nowhere near a plane and yet they're anxious. And they know that if they don't go near a plane and they start to allow their mind, their anxiety will go away. So why would they want to challenge that by going up on a plane? Not in a million years. So ego anxiety is the same principle. So you'll have people who don't want to speak in public. That's the classic one, really. In fact, on surveys around the world, people fear speaking in public more than they fear death. Death comes down at 2 or 3, speaking in public comes at number 1. Now, I find that a little bit ironic. And it's all about what will people think of me. And it's obviously, they won't think I'm brilliant and great and what a guy. They'll think negative things and negative thoughts, and that's, to our brain, that is serious stuff. And that is danger, and we need to get away from that. Abnormalizing the normal. So if somebody comes into you and they say that, so for example, somebody close to them has died, and they are now a number of months afterwards, and they're coming in and they're telling you, oh, this is happening, and that's happening. They're feeling awful, and they have no energy, no motivation, whatever. Very often they just need to be told, that's quite normal. You know, your mother, your father's died, you're now 3 months down the line, and you're worried about this. Sure. How would people in your position, do you think they feel? Abnormalizing the normal is panic. Panic, you're anxious, and people then get worked up about it and anxious about the fact that they are feeling anxious. What we're doing is we're normalizing that. You're feeling anxious, an awful feeling, absolutely. Chest pain, yeah, absolutely. Breathing, all tight, absolutely, I understand that completely. But that's actually quite normal. It's quite normal to feel like that. And lastly, the need for control. So what would you think if somebody came to into the surgery, and they said to you, "I got a pain in my chest last week," and I'd say, "Oh, yeah, fine. You worry about it. Just wondering, was it a heart attack?" Now, the question I would ask is, if you got a chest pain on a Thursday and you thought it was a heart attack, would you be waiting until the following Wednesday to go to the doctor and say, "I think, do you know, was Thursday, was that a heart attack?" Do you know? So really, when you examine that, they don't really think that it was a heart attack. But what they want you to tell them is that it definitely wasn't a heart attack. Because what about if the next pain in my chest? Well, okay, it mightn't have been that time. What about the next time? They want 100% guarantees that everything is going to be okay. Now, you can't give people 100% guarantees. And people try to take control as much as they can to guarantee outcomes. And you can't do that. And unfortunately, but people can get really anxious. So again, it's one of the reasons why people will present to surgeries with kind of problems and looking for reassurance. The pain in my back, you know, how would you know it's not cancer, doctor? But we checked all that out. Okay, but that was 6 months ago. How do you know it's not cancer this time? Do you know? And you can't keep on checking symptoms out just because people will keep presenting them. Then there's something else going on there. And very often it's an underlying need for control. I need to know, I need to be certain, I need to guarantee to me that this pain in my back is nothing bad and I'll be fine. So again, you're not going to be able to do that, because, you know, maybe the pain in a year's time will be something more serious, and you don't know that. So what you're doing is you're working on the need they have for control, and they have to bring them around for being a little bit having to be satisfied that, you know what, we're not going to know all the time. When you're tackling the anxiety, I think it's very important to look at the normal measures we encourage people with regard to mental health and physical health. And sometimes the whole level of anxieties for people can be toned down by working on some of these factors that might be missing. So for example, if somebody's drinking a lot, they wake up the following morning and they feel anxious. Very often that has to do with alcohol levels dropping down, the sedative effect of alcohol is now wearing off, and people start getting, the nervous system wakes up a little bit. And if there's any tendency to anxiety at all, people wake up and they feel a bit uncomfortable or whatever, and suddenly they're into some sort of anxious state. Lack of sleep, exercise is really good for helping anxiety and generalized anxiety. Endorphins are a great natural antidote to anxiety. And the other thing, if you think about it, the anxiety process is adrenaline and going around the body. Well, exercising, you're using the adrenaline. That's what you're exactly doing. So it's the perfect antidote to feeling anxious is get exercise, because you're actually then using the reaction in your body for the purpose that it was primarily intended for. Mindfulness, relaxation. Yeah, just a word about mindfulness. Again, telling somebody that's anxious, just relax, it's not a good plan. So why would I say mindfulness and relaxation routines? Well, telling somebody who's acutely anxious just relax mightn't be effective, but generally having some relaxation exercises or routines to lessen the chances of you getting anxious in the first place is very good. And sometimes when people know that it's just me being anxious and that there's no need for me to be getting uptight about it and whatever, and having some sort of relaxation routine can help them then to tone the anxiety down and turn the gas down. Social connection, purpose, positive values, these are just very, in general, very good ways of helping, of just mental health in general. We're social animals, friendships are important. It's huge evidence to say that people involved in a tribe, you know, their own people, whatever, live longer, simple as that. Religious, people involved in religious congregations live longer. They're there with like-minded people and being connected. And if you look at societies, places in Japan, in part of Sardinia, where the population, they live longer. There's huge emphasis on social connection and social groups. Having purpose. We've all heard the stories of people retiring, getting their watch on Monday and being dead within 2, 3, 4 weeks, months, year or two, because again, unless it's prepared for, people lose their sense of purpose and they lose their drive. And it's amazing how bad health and poor mental health can follow. An attitude. I had somebody to me the other day, and he said, we were talking about some of these things, and he said, positive attitude. That's what gets him out of things. That's what gets him and keeps him on track. And that's it. So basically, if I was to sum it up, I'd say we all get anxious. Every single one of us. Right? Whether we like it or not, because there's dangers all around, according to our brains anyway. However, we don't have to get panic. Panic is just getting anxious about anxious. So all we have to tell ourselves is this is only anxiety. Even if you're feeling like crap, it is only anxiety. And that's all it is. And once your brain does not get the stimulation to say, oh my God, there's more danger, you will not get panic. Anxiety is not to be cured. Anxiety is just to be dealt with and managed. And it happens to all of us. It's not a disease. It's not some sort of condition that's contagious and that we all have it. And people do use medicines to help it, more so than we should. Unfortunately, some of the medicines we use, benzodiazepines, and more recently, pregabalin or Lyrica, they've become highly abused medicines. And people are dying, they've street value. So we try to keep away from medicines if we can with regard to anxiety, because at the end of the day, it's not a disease. It is something that we all get in response to, it's just our body trying to, our brain trying to protect us from danger and just not having the tools to properly do it. Thanks. I tell people CBT for Dummies. The Dummies series. That's good. It's a good generalized one, and there's a lot of good stuff in it, and it's easy read and that sort of thing. Yeah. So that's what I generally tell people. Anything else?
You know, when you were saying that there's two kind of paths or ways to do CBT, two different guys. Would you say there's one that works more? People work.
Tend to use both. So for the panic, it's nearly all the way that Beck was doing it, just to try and look at what the thoughts are in your head and try to calm them down and see, how reasonable does it look like that this person is whatever. But then we have people, I suppose there's people with the ego anxiety, there's people go through life and they think that we're on a ladder. Okay? Our worth and value as a human being is on a ladder. So if we do really, really well at something, we're obviously going back up the ladder, right? If we do badly at something, we're going down the ladder compared to everybody else. So it's all comparisons. And the other thing is where we are on the ladder depends on what people think about us, right? So if people think we're great and whatever, we must be way up the top of this ladder. But if people think that, whatever, and which is the fear of rejection, well, we must be down there somewhere up the ladder. And our job is to try and get up that ladder as high as we can and stay up there as high as we can. And the problem with that thinking is that it just gets us all into trouble. Because at the end of the day, people will like us if we keep giving them what they want. And if we give them what they don't want, they won't like us anymore. Simple as that. So the point about it is the fact that you feel that you can give everybody what they want all the time, you can't do that. So this fictitious ladder is what gets people into trouble, which is what ego anxiety is. So the thing about it is trying to persuade people and tell people that, maybe not everyone will think you're like that, really doesn't shake this whole ladder thing. Whereas Ellis would tell you, there's no fucking ladder in the first place. We're all the same. We're all exactly the same. Some of us are good at some things, and yeah, they mightn't like you, but that's not, that's because you're not giving them what they want. And if you start giving what they want, they'll think you're great. And really, just because you're good at one thing today and you're not good at it tomorrow, does that mean you're a lesser person, somehow worthless as an individual or a human being? Or just because lots of people like you, you're a great person? Do you know, Tiger Woods was the most phenomenal golfer that I would say that has ever played golf. And he was winning everything. People thought he was fantastic. At the same time, he was screwing around left, right, and center. So what is he? Is he brilliant or is he a dog? Right? Which is it? Everyone thought he was brilliant when they didn't hear about the fact that he was sleeping around all over the place. And then when they heard about it, they thought, oh my God, what an awful man. But he was doing it at the same time. So what was he like? Was he brilliant or was he awful? Well, what Ellis would say is, brilliant golfer, but a crap husband. Do you know? And that's fine. Golfing was something he did. Husbanding was something he did. And he was good at one, and he was crap at another. I'm sure there were other things too, and other things he wasn't so good at. Do you know? I'd say he wasn't great at Irish dancing, for example. Again, does that make him somehow a lesser human being? Well, Ellis would say, absolutely not. We're all the same. And one analogy which I think is very nice is pretend that we're all a capital I. You know, one of these eyes with eye with thing in front, and it's like a suit. And we're all sitting there now, and you're all eyes. And I look at the, and you're all exactly the same. I can't tell the difference between any one of you, right? But then you've a zipper down the front here. So I come along, I put down the zipper, and all these tiny little eyes fall out, right? And all these eyes are your skills, your characteristics, and there's thousands of them in there. And your eye and your thousands of little eyes falling out are completely different from all the eyes that fall out from your, when we put down your zipper. And your zipper completely different. I was wondering how long it would take you to go there. So these are all skills. So Tiger Woods, that's his golfing skill. And that's brilliant and it's fantastic. It's way up there. But he has a husbanding skill too that really isn't much talk about. He's a father's skill, he's a son's skill, he's got all these things, a gardening skill no doubt, and all these things inside there. And he's a unique combination of all these little characteristics and all these skills, and he's good at some and he's bad at the other. And take anybody else and they're all the same, but their combination is completely different. And in fact, we all have a unique combination of these small little eyes, for want of a better phrase, of these skills, of these characteristics, and how can you compare one with the other? It's like chalk and cheese. You can't compare one with the other. So if you're 9 out of 10 on the fathering front, and that makes you, and you're only 8 out of 10 on the Irish dancing front, oh, and well, he's much better than he is. Makes no sense. And so the Albert Ellis way of saying, you know, we're all the same anyway. We're just good at some things and bad at the other things, so there is no ladder. Whereas Ellis would be a little bit, it's hard to get away from the ladder business because kind of saying, ah, yeah, you are all right. Sure, aren't you good at this? And you're, and nobody, everyone thinks you're all right and probably and whatever. So there is only a very slight difference between the two, but some of the problems respond better to one rather than the other. That answer.
So if there's no more questions, I suppose just finish up by saying thanks, it was a brilliant talk. I just thought it was I found it quite inspiring actually, that the way it was so eloquent and it was all very accessible to everyone. So if you just give one more thanks.